Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 11th, 2000. In the fireside room this evening, we have Larry Rasmussen. Today's session number is RAL 2002. Today he is continuing his series called Deep Christian Traditions as Earth Faiths, and today's individual title is Mary Knoll Ecological Sanctuary, Philippines. Let's listen in.
Yesterday, that one, that this project is twofold. One is to document the communities that are already living an earth positive or an earth honoring a way of life, and secondly, to reread the deep traditions of Christianity. With a view to how those traditions that we draw on might become the basis for expressions of Christianity, that in which fidelity to God is lived as fidelity to the earth, in which earth and its distress is the Christian's song of songs. In the case of the Mary Knoll Ecological Sanctuary, they are drawing on several of these deep traditions. The Mary Knoll sisters are a Roman Catholic religious order, and they come out of a Roman Catholic sacramentalism in which the whole universe is regarded as sacred, if you will. They also come out of a tradition of mysticism and the contemplative life. So their daily routine is one in which the hours are kept. Prayer and meditation are important parts of their daily life. They also come out of the Roman Catholic monastic tradition of asceticism. That is to say, yes is said to one way of life and no is said to another way of life. Saying yes and saying no in order to form a disciplined community. Pleasing to God. And what is striking is that the sacramentalism, the asceticism, and the mysticism is all creation-filled. Asceticism, sacramentalism, and mysticism. If you know some of the female or some of the women medieval saints, like Hildegard of Bingen, etc., you know some of the people that are important to the Mary Knoll Ecological Sanctuary. But in addition to that, they are drawing upon the traditions that are the traditions of the indigenous peoples of the Philippines, because they work with the peoples of the Cordillera Mountains. And so the Ecological Sanctuary, and I'll tell you about it in some detail, is really Filipino through and through in its expression. However, the last thing to say is that it is a theology and a spirituality that is deeply informed by the new creation story as told by science now, by the sometimes called the new science. In this case, serving a notion of Christianity, which, as I mentioned yesterday, is a justice-centered Christianity. They're working all the time for social and environmental justice. And they don't think they're being Christian unless that is their focus. And I need to spend just a few minutes with you to talk about the interplay of this new story of science and those Christian traditions that they draw upon. And you'll see when we get to their portrayal of the cosmic journey why that place of science is so critical to their understanding of Christian faith. I'm going to start with comment of Alfonso X of Castile and León, sometimes called Alfonso the Wise, from the 13th century. Alfonso said, If the Lord Almighty had consulted me before embarking on the creation, I'd have recommended something simpler. Simpler, we did not get. What we got was innumerable dappled things and the riot of life, infinite in every direction, not to mention billions of galaxies in an expanding cosmos still on its pilgrim journey. The whole creation, Annie Dillard says, is one lunatic fringe. In nature, improbabilities are the one stock in trade. No claims of any and all revelation, she goes on, could be so far-fetched as a single giraffe. So, can we do justice to creation as Christians or even as human beings? Probably not. Not even in the unexplored contours of our skimpy imaginations. Left to one species, whether Homo sapiens sapiens or another, we'd invariably recommend something simpler than the creation we've got. We'd have creation in our image and not God's. The imagination turned in on itself is no less than the heart turned in on itself, the seat of sin. Our most fertile imagination would never come up with a giraffe as a neighbor to love on equal terms with ourselves and as kin in the community of life. But if we can't do justice to the whole creation, even in our imagination, as one lunatic fringe, can we do better than we're doing now? And the answer is yes, emphatically, but only if something like eco-justice, a new word since the rise of and popularity of the word ecology. As Christians, we can only do justice to creation if something like eco-justice is central to Christian faith. And we're truly at home in the cosmos. Are human beings truly at home in the cosmos? And the Maryknoll Ecological Sanctuary wants to say emphatically, yes, and it's the only place we're at home. They live with the conviction that the greatest scientific discovery of the 20th century is that nature, or creation, if you want to use a theological word, and that's what it is, that nature is a community. And it's ours is a relational universe in which all things evolve together. There's a kind of fierce ontology of communion at the heart of things, across creation as a lunatic fringe. It all belongs together. It all evolves together. So we are not an ecologically segregated species. I call that apartheid thinking at the species level. We're part of a dynamic, relational, evolutionary creation. Self-determination, self-organization, self-renewal are the marks of all of nature, including human nature. And the Mary Knoll Ecological Sanctuary has been deeply influenced by this understanding that we belong, we are at home in the cosmos, and we belong to the story of creation as an evolutionary story that began 15 billion years ago, and that we're a part of that story. And they understand that story of science as the revelation of God. The primordial revelation of God is the universe itself, of which we are an intrinsic part and are literally stardust, along with everything else. They were influenced, they have been influenced deeply by Thomas Berry, and he's the person I mentioned yesterday when I told you, recommended the book, The Great Work. Tom Berry did a couple of other books, one of which was a major prize winner called The Dream of the Earth, an earlier one, and then one with Brian Swim called The Universe Story. And the Filipino and the U.S.-American sisters who were working in Baguio were deeply influenced by Berry. And now let me describe that, because I think it'll come clear, and then after I've described the sanctuary to you as best I can with some word pictures, then I'll try to show you by holding up the laptop. Incidentally, I've also put up a photo essay in the dining hall. It's a photo essay on the sun as the sun on what Luther called the majesty of matter. The sun on the majesty of matter as the reflected glory of God. And the text that goes along with the photos is there that explains this. But I'm mentioning that to you now, not only to invite you to take a look at it, especially in the morning when there's some sun in the dining room, and that corner is better lit, but also because there are some photos there from the ecological sanctuary, and you'll have a chance to look at it better than you can under these conditions. On a July afternoon in 1990, an hour or so after the school children had been dismissed for the day, the ground of the fabled Cordillera Mountains shuddered, heaved, settled, and slid. An earthquake of 7+ on the Richter scale rocked Baguio, the city of pines, and laid it low. The destruction was massive and the loss of life was staggering, not least because the second strong tremor arrived 40 minutes after the first, just long enough to lure people back into their weakened homes to survey the ruin and take shelter from the torrential rains that continued to fall. The epicenter itself was some 30 miles away, and Baguio probably should not have buckled as it did. But the gold and silver and copper mines that have hollowed out those steep mountains rendered the city more vulnerable than it otherwise would have been. At least that's the conviction of the populace, which is itself both dependent on the international mining and timbering corporations and at the same time resentful of them. We talked yesterday briefly about the three waves of globalization and the international economy of extractive economy is very much the economy of Baguio. And this extractive economy provides the work for the people and at the same time hauls the wealth away, leaving the scars in a population that must grudgingly ask for more. Atop the mountain knob defined by the Marcos Highway and Santo Tomas Road, I love this, Ferdinand Marcos Highway and St. Thomas Road, the 62-year-old convent of the Mary Knoll Sisters lay in ruins. Just a second here. Like the adjoining schools, it rested on one of the fault lines, directly on the fault lines. Well, after emergency care, and one of their buildings wasn't badly damaged, and it became a center for shelter for the neighborhood, the question became, what do we do now? Do we rebuild somehow and take up where we left off, which was primarily elementary education and social justice advocacy work with the urban poor and with the tribal communities of the surrounding mountains, or what? Is that what we do, or do we do something else? Well, over the course of the next 7 years, an answer took form, and the form was the Maryknoll Ecological Sanctuary, with its Center for the Integrity of Creation, its Cosmic Journey, and its Bioshelter. The Bioshelter is what commands the immediate attention of anyone coming around this busy corner, because the sanctuary is on top of a heavily populated, is in a heavily populated part of the city. It may not sound like that to you when you hear ecological sanctuary, but it's right in the heart of the urban area. I'll show you after a while. There's one large and two small pyramidal structures of blue and white and green that stand against the sky with much wood, glass, stone, and ironwork, and a remarkable sense of openness that contemplates the feel and the smell of sunlight on these old-growth pines. The style, which is both ancient and avant-garde at the same time, draws its basic lines from the traditional houses of the Ifugao peoples of the Cordillera. And at the same time, it's very sleek, very simple, very high-tech in the best manner of modern architecture and engineering. It's a pyramidal structure because the traditional housing of the peoples of the mountain is a pyramidal structure of intentionally that way as a sign of earth to sky, or earth to heaven. The entire complex is the new amidst the old, and that's important for them. The new often resurrected from the old. A small hermitage for guests on retreat sits in the garden close by, itself built of recycled convent ruins and resting on the slab where the convent kitchen had been. Next door, the jagged old convent foundations, I'll show you a picture, now hosts the flowered archways of the new environmental theater, where the children from the school for the deaf, that elementary school was closed in order to do something called earth education across many classes, not just elementary, but the school for the deaf was retained, and the children from the school for the deaf in the Center for the Integrity of Creation always dance earth prayers to open any seminar or conference or public meeting that is held there, and I'll show you a couple of pictures. And one of the pictures in the photo essay on the sun in the dining hall up here is a picture of a spirit of helplessness and hopelessness being exorcised in a dance in one of these earth prayers. In the bioshelter itself, the exquisite and locally designed and crafted cabinets, tables, chairs, door molding, staircase, and banister were all taken from the three large mountain pines that had to be felled to make room for the house. Those fallen pines themselves were replaced by 10 seedlings each in a ritual that was created for the occasion, so that the old pines were thanked for their gifts to the ongoing community, and then they used them for virtually all of the woodwork in the house. Well, whether to rebuild and in what manner required extensive discernment, not to say fundraising. Several of the sisters had lived, as many of them had before, in the tradition of asceticism. So they had lived in very spare, ascetic, simple quarters, in their ministries in Bolivia and in Nicaragua and elsewhere in the Philippines. And so one of the questions was, should we continue to live in that way? The decision for this state-of-the-art bio-shelter instead of a convent was that it would be a home for the sisters, hospitality for guests, and perhaps above all, a kind of medium of earth education and earth spirituality. Thus it was designed on the religious premise that our inner lives and our outer lives are not separate domains, so much as different dimensions of the very same cosmic reality. And on the design premise that practical inspiration comes through nature and comes from nature. Windows and skylights are maximized with a view to mountain sunlight. Rainwater running down the skylights, the roof, is collected and it's piped through the pillars of the sacred space. It's piped through the pillars of the chapel, which is at the center of this of the big pyramid, the sacred space in the center of the house. And then it's piped, the runoff water is piped through the chapel. So when you go in the chapel and it's raining, you hear running water. Or after a rain, you hear running water. You don't see it, you just hear it. And then it goes out into an area that is where a wetland is being created. Solar heating is used extensively together with maximum recycling and composting of materials of all kinds. There's a commitment to the bioregion, to the area, and its peoples, and that means always purchasing local materials and furnishing, using local building materials and the crafts and the designs of local workers, gardening and decorating with indigenous plant species, reforesting with tree species that are native to those grounds, etc. So you're beginning to hear how they want nature in their locale to be, they want to be an expression of it and it an expression of them. Thus the house, the bioshelter, is a shelter wholly integrated into this notion of the ecological sanctuary itself. Now, any casual passerby might confuse it with a prize-winning domicile featured in some prestigious architecture magazine, and you wouldn't expect that some low-paid nuns were living there and had designed it. But the house, that house, if it were owned by the wealthy, would be somewhere else and not in one of the poorer portions of the city of Baguio. Right amidst the squatters, because there's a lot of movement of the people from the countryside into the city looking for work, as in most cities in the so-called third world. But the purpose of this house is also different than one that would look like it in some other locale, namely to serve Earth in this place amidst its serious degradation, and to do so with beauty and a way to live modestly and humbly, in tune with nature, even in tune with the cosmos. Now, what does that mean, in tune with the cosmos? As I mentioned, the center of the bio-shelter convent has an octagonal shaft that is what they call the sacred space. And it's the first of two cosmic journeys in the ecological sanctuary. It's an enclosed space, sharply vertical, kind of womb-like. And when you walk in there, and you walk in from the east and you exit to the west, that also has meaning, you're immediately stilled. The eye is lifted to the rather rich colors of eight stained glass windows. Eight, which is the number of the windows and the walls, is a symbol of the new creation. and here in this rather vividly colored glass is one cosmic journey told in Filipino. The fish of the South China Sea there are there, the mountains and the stormy skies of the Cordilleras, the life-giving rains, the lush foliage, the mountain peoples themselves, the lilies met in the wild, the animals that are a part of every village neighborhood, the Philippine eagle, which is a large endangered raptor and the national symbol, and the beginning of the cosmic journey itself. The first window is the Big Bang. It's just the aboriginal flaring forth of the universe from the heart of God, and then it goes around from that first window. And then your eye is drawn from the glass higher up to the open space above, which is circled with a wrought iron balcony and a brief kind of pause of open air before the translucent pyramid of the roof and the sky beyond. And if you're up above and you can go up above and look into the sacred space, you're looking at the floor and you're seeing a four-directional Cairo in brass, which is the sign of the cosmic Christ. So this is all a way of saying that everything you see in those eight stained glass windows belongs to the creation understood in terms of the cosmic Christ. Now people, when they come into the sacred space, do utter words, they do sing, but most people find themselves simply stilled by the space itself and spend their time in prayer and meditation. Now I want to try and show you some pictures of this. Let's see what we get. And then I'll go to the other cosmic journey, which is 14 stations of the cosmic journey on the mountainside around the bioshelter. This has, images take a long time. I have so much memory. Come on, folks. Okay, I don't know if, how well you, is there light from that window that's, can you see this or not?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Okay. That's just the sign. Here's some of the staff. Two Filipina sisters are missing. The two U.S. sisters, Ann Broaddus and Pat Nichols, are there, and the rest are Filipino staff. What so impressed me about these folks is that whether it's the gardener or the mechanic or the receptionist or the school teacher in the school or the deaf or the cook, all of them take people on the cosmic journey, the one around the mountaintop, because it's their story. It isn't that you've got one sister who does it. It's truly their story. Do you see the bioshelter? I mean, tell me if I need to go this way. Yeah?
Just hold it still.
Hold it still, yes. That's what you need to tell me. Okay, then you can see the big pyramid and the sacred space is in the large pyramid. And the two smaller pyramids are above the living space. And the space for both the sisters living there and for guests is very sparse. And I just wanted to show you the traditional housing of the Ifugua people, because that's where it got its inspiration. It was from local traditions. And likewise, all of the construction is done by local craftspersons, and including the designers. This is the environmental theater on the grounds of the former convent that was destroyed. And in the theater, you know, I mentioned that that's where the earth prayers are danced at the beginning of any conference. Here are the students from the School of the Deaf dancing earth prayers to open a meeting. It might be a meeting of the advocacy groups of the urban poor, or it might be a coalition of people working on the mining and timbering issues. This is the poor guy who had to be exorcised, who got kicked out of the environmental theater because he was the spirit of hopelessness and helplessness. And they didn't want any hopelessness and helplessness. So the students made all the masks. And this is the offering of rice, which is the offering to God in heaven. And this is, you exercise the spirit of helplessness and hopelessness, and to get on with your work, you make an offering of rice. Rice is heaven. Rice is the bread of life. This is the entry now to the cosmic journey on the mountainside, not in the temple. I mean, not in the bioshelter, not the sacred space, but the cosmic journey on the mountainside. And Gerdy, a local Filipino artist who does Stone Age pottery, he's an expert in it, constructed this cosmic gate where you go in. Now, I don't know if you remember Dante's sign over the gates of hell, "All who enter here abandon hope." So Erdi, who's got a whimsical side to himself, has over the cosmic gate, "All who enter here, enjoy!" And the first station of the 14 stations then is, of course, the emergence of the universe, the Big Bang, the beginning. So it says here the universe came into being 15 billion years ago, so that's your first stop. And it's portrayed by the Filipino artist simply as this kind of altar of rock. There are three stones and a slab and another rock on top and then fire. So you got rock, fire, air, if you wish, as a way in which you're portraying the emergence of the universe. Now, the second station is the emergence of Earth, so we jump immediately. I mean, this is skipping billions and this is skipping 10 billion years here. But we've jumped 10 billion years, and the second station is the emergence of Earth. And you can't see it too easily in there, but in the center is our solar system. There's the sun, and then out from the sun are like petals that go out, and at the end of them are planets. One of those planets is under the Alpha Gate, which is right here. And this was one of the artists, I've forgotten his name, is deaf, is a fabulous artist, and it was his idea that everyone had to enter this second station by crawling through the Alpha Gate, Alpha for beginning. And Earth is this tiny rock in the center of the Alpha Gate. So you touch Earth with your palm of your hand as you crawl into the solar system through the Alpha Gate, through the beginning. And if you turned over on your back and looked up through the Alpha Gate, there are two holes, and that's what you would see. You would see the pines, the old growth pines of Baguio. So this is a picture taken on my back, looking up through the Alpha Gate. So that's the second station. Now I don't have pictures all, well, I do have pictures, but they're not all arranged here, for all the 14 stations, so you're not going to see all of them. This is the emergence of the seas. And you see Peg Dillon here, one of the sisters, with a group of Filipinos, families that have come to go on the cosmic journey. And what she's doing with especially the children there is that she's at the edge of a basin that has salt water in it and that has large fossilized clams in it. So these are that were collected. So she then talks about the fact that most of the planet is water, 70%. Your body is 70% water. Life probably emerged from the seas. You spent your first months, nine of them, in salt water. And so you are the universe is you. And then she'll splash them with the salt water and talk about the waters of baptism as the waters of life. So there's a little ritual that's done at each station, which is a part of the Earth education, just basic scientific education, and a part of an education for an Earth spirituality. That's what's going on there, whether the kids are 3 or 93. And like I said, most anyone on the staff does this, and they change. They make up their rituals. I mean, that's how religion goes. You make it up as you go, basically. What is this? Flowers spread on the Earth 130 million years ago. I skipped the one on green plants. That's an important difference. Green plants do some things, like let you breathe. Flowers, but the emergence of flowers is something else because it's food for a whole lot of the riot of life in this one lunatic fringe that we're all a part of. Ernie has a sense of humor, as I mentioned, and he did the station on the emergence of dinosaurs. So you come along, and I was the one that took the two pieces off the top. They would be there. You come along, and you see this big white egg. And you can see it's cracked, so you're tempted to take the pieces off, and you do, and here's a baby dinosaur. Diapers. So, folks had a good time. And here's the emergence of primates 65 million years ago. Which is a parent and a little one. Now this is the emergence of human beings, and what they did was take the cave in the Philippines in which the oldest human remains were found, and they recreated that cave as the station. And then, as I mentioned, Erdi, one of the artists, does Stone Age pottery. He sits out there in front of the cave and does that. But then you go farther, and then you walk across this suspension bridge, which is also a recreation of an old suspension bridge in the Philippines, into the villages. And this is the Neolithic revolution. It's actually a Neolithic revolution that took place over about 10,000 to 8,000 years ago, the beginning of settled society, human society, gradual emergence from a hunting and gathering period. And then from the suspension bridge, you look down into a clearing, which represents a hunting and gathering period. So you're literally passing from that into the Neolithic period. This is just the slight recreation of the Neolithic village. And there's usually somebody weaving there and in accord with the arts of the time. Now we're going to jump and finish here. Near the end, they set up a special several substations, if you will, for the emergence of the Earth's religions. And of course they come very late. If you took the story of evolution as the revelation of God on this timeline, and laid it out as a football field of 100 yards, the human time and space in that 100 yards would be the width of a hair at the end of the football field. So we haven't been around here very long, and world religions have been around here even less. What appears first, and it shows the strong Catholic feminism of this group, is the statue of Earth as a pregnant woman. That's what you first come upon. And in the history of religions, it's very wide. The goddess religions are very widespread as old religious traditions. And Earth is often expressed in terms of the fertile woman. So that's the first one you come to. And then you come to what people now often call world religions, because they're large in number and often in many different places. This is Buddhism. And what the people at the sanctuary did was ask the students from Nepal at the university. Baguio has a number, it's an educational center. And they asked the students of Nepal, who were Buddhist, to design the station. So you see the third eye of the Buddha there. That's just the wall, you know, but very, very simple and very effective, I think. This is Judaism. You see the Torah on the lectern, and it's open to a verse from Deuteronomy that says, justice and only justice shall you do, and then the land that the Lord has God has given you shall be yours. And then there is, you can see the menorah done as a stone pathway. Can you see that? And it ends at a recreation of the Wailing Wall. And you are invited to write earth prayers and put them in the Wailing Wall. In Jerusalem, you're invited to stick prayer in the cracks between the stones. Well, now I'm taking you inside. This is the sacred space in the bio shelter, the other cosmic journey, looking down from the balcony at the Cairo, the four directions of the cosmic Christ, set in this brass ring in the floor. This is the first window, the flaming forth of the universe from the heart of God, the Big Bang. And if you're on the outside, which you can't be because the rooms and some of the reading spaces up there, this is translucent, the middle piece, so you look into you look into the sacred space through the middle of that window. The emergence of green plants as part of the cosmic journey, one of the stained glass windows. The emergence of culture and agriculture. You see the rice paddies of the Philippines, and you see human beings, and you see baskets, etc. They've done their own revisionism. And this picture of this person with the spear now, instead of a spear for war, these are protectors of the earth. So that's their own take on this. Here, a picture of the stained glass window with the birds and the Philippine raptor, the eagle, the endangered. And these are the animals you see in every village in the Philippines. I don't know if you have these in your church or not, but they do in theirs. To put this in context, these are the open pit mines of the communities with which the ecological sanctuary works. The mining interests have gotten the deposits from inside the mine, and the remaining ore deposits are accessible then from above. It's called bulk mining. They aren't tunnels like we've got in Copper Mountain here. You take out the middle of the mountain. You just haul it away, truckload by truckload. And so it's a hollowed out mountain. And to get at the rest of the ore, you do this. Now, the people of the Corrientes, the tribal communities, live mountains. And if I had a pointer, I could point to some of them. You know, you can see that house. And below the minings, we've got a situation like we have at Holden. The river that runs through the Corrientes is at the in the valley here, below the strip mining. Here, can you see the river? Yeah. And the river is badly polluted by the whole mining process. You see the rice paddies alongside the river, because this is where the terracing. So that's outside the city. Inside the city, you've got another kind of problem of degradation. This is directly across the valley from the ecological sanctuary. And you see what's happening to the mountain there? It's being notched out, deforested and notched out in order to build housing. You see the blue tents? Here's one. Here's another. Those are squatters' quarters. And eventually, this mountaintop will look like the one back here, which is solid housing on top of the mountain. You know what happens if you're in a country of mountains where you have monsoons, if you don't have the forests, if you don't have the trees. Well, that's what's happening to Baguio as well. So the ecological sanctuary is in part an effort to say we can live amidst these magnificent pine trees, but we've got to address the problems of poverty and address the problems of the economy, which is in part the international economy that generates the kinds of conditions that send people to the cities where, in this case, the housing can't be sustained by the land itself. Okay, I think, yeah, that's it.
Do the Marinos have, two questions. Is that order getting enough new people coming into it so that it will be sustaining over a period of time? And then what kind of cooperation are they having from the Filipino government?
And to your first question, the Roman Catholic orders of the sisters, by and large, are not getting enough new members to replace the retiring ones as what they call vowed sisters. But they have an arrangement whereby you can be a friend of the Marinoles as a lay person and not take vows, but you're a part of all of the activities there, the spirituality. You in effect live the same kind of life, except you may do it in the context of your own family, maybe celibate or not celibate. And you're on the committees, etc. So it's like a lay order, and that's growing in this case and in many cases. And so some of the orders looked at that way are thriving, but they often have very serious problems with their own institutions now, because they have large institutions and they've got a heavy bill for retiring sisters and health care for sisters. So that's how that's handled. On the one hand, it's it's declining in another way. It's quite alive. With respect to the Filipino government, it's often a touchy situation because they're involved in advocacy work that has led them into a whole lot of protests at the collusion of the Filipino government with international corporations for the logging and mining. And the mining companies, incidentally, when they have rights, they have not only have rights to the mine, they have rights to the they have the rights to the timber and their water rights.
Mm-hmm.
So they have the monopoly on the essentials of that land. And on that count, the sisters and the brothers too, Merino fathers, I mean, the Merino fathers and the Merino sisters have, together with the network of advocacy groups, have often been in trouble with the Filipino government on this issue or that issue. But one thing about those orders, they're usually not nearly in nearly so much danger as the Filipinos who are a part of the non-governmental organizations, because as Roman Catholic orders, they have an independent base. That's a great advantage as a matter of strategy for a lot of people, because they're not subject to just the same intimidation that many citizens would be. They're part of an international organization with some clout, namely the Roman Catholic Church. What other comments or questions?
So what kind of relationship do they have with the diocese, or how do they sit within the Catholic structure?
Well, I think it varies from place to place depending on how friendly the bishop is. In some places it's quite tense because, again, they have an independence in their own base. They're not subject to the bishop of the diocese. And oftentimes they want to work very, very closely because in the Philippines, popular Catholicism is very strong and they want to be a part of that. So it depends on, in Baguio, for example, there was a lot of tension between the local bishop and the local diocese and these Merino sisters. But that isn't always the case.
But like, is this the type of thing that if you went to a traditional Catholic church in Baguio, would you hear about the center, the Merino center, like with, or are they kind of...
Yeah, I think you often would because they've been there so long and are so prominent in certain critical areas like education. An awfully lot of education, including elementary education, has been done by... So Merino graduates are sort of everywhere. That's a pretty strong alum organization. And in fact, one of the reasons they get so much done is that they know somebody in City Hall, or they know somebody in that company there because they're Merino graduates. I got that kind of thing.
Larry?
Yeah.
When Mary and I were there a year ago, March, and the Filipino lady who was sort of our tour guide gave us the impression that both the military and tourism had an inordinate effect upon the Baguio area. I've been expecting to hear something from you, and so I asked.
Yeah, well, I can't tell you a whole lot. It is a major military site, and not too far away. Clark Air Force Base was where the U.S. was for a while, and that was a very touchy issue.
Right.
And many of the Filipinos didn't want the United States there any longer. The government did. Mount Pinatubo took care of that. It was the volcano that blew up, that got rid of Clark Air Force Base. It was a mess. But tourism, Baguio is a gorgeous area, and it is a real draw for Filipinos and others. It's a beautiful mountain region in the Sea of China. So there are a lot of tourists coming there, and it makes for serious traffic problems. At the same time, they want the input for the economy. And the Marinol Ecological Sanctuary worries about the impact on the poor, but it's extremely difficult because it does create jobs, and there are a lot of people that need jobs. There are people that come to the Marinol Ecological Sanctuary who are in Baguio as tourists, and so the sanctuary is grateful to be able to do this kind of earth education with the tourists. And there are a lot of people that come to the sanctuary. So on the one hand, you have all of the problematic of so-called third world tourism. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, it belongs to a set of cruel choices that our people often have to make around basic need for jobs and income.
I have one question. How did it weave in the Christian story of like Noah's Ark or something like that, and regeneration of the planet again within amongst all the other religions?
Pardon? I'm sorry, I didn't get the question.
A story like Noah's Ark, you know, and the regeneration of Earth again, how's that as a Christian viewpoint weaved in with the Hindus and the the Tibetans and the Buddhists and the, goes on and forth? Did they weave that in and out? Did they teach that, since it is sort of a nunnery sort of base type thing? Did they just sort of leave that sort of aspect of, they had the timeline, the infinite timeline stuff, mm-hmm. they sort of put a mark in there for that, or what? Mm-hmm.
No.
Because I know that what I've read, every local tribe in the world has their flood story.
It's a common one,
And so somehow it relates to all of them somehow.
Yeah, no, it's an excellent question. I should say, first of all, that the people doing the cosmic journey, whether it's one of the sisters or other people on the staff, don't try to represent Buddhism or Islam or Judaism at those stations. I mean, beyond basically basics about that. So they're not trying to do more than that. But with respect to both Christianity and the stories of origin and destiny, which most people have a story of origin, a creation story. And most peoples have a story of destiny. Where is it all going to end? What eventually is going to happen? The cosmic journey, the new story of science, this creation story, is the framework, as our common story. And then the other stories of creation are welcomed into a kind of conversation. And for the Marinol sisters themselves, the Genesis accounts, or you have other creation stories in the Bible too, mm-hmm. creation accounts, are all a lively kind of conversation with the story, the common creation story of evolution. So you might get into some arguments, but very much, it's very much the case that it's a kind of, the local creation accounts are a kind of local expression of a meaningful universe. It's the story that tells the story of a people and what's important to that people. And it finds its place within this larger common creation story. So that's basically how it's handled. And so the story of Noah, for example, which says again and again and again, I, meaning Yahweh, establish a covenant between me and all living flesh. I establish a covenant between me and the earth. The first covenant is a covenant of God and the earth. Abraham comes and Sarah comes quite a bit later. So you can see how that fits with then within this explication of the common creation story. Okay, likewise, the creation story of the Ifugao people fits. And that's why the staff members who are Filipino are so at ease with this, because their particular stories of place and of people can fit within this. It's not a competing story, despite the Board of Education in Kansas's vote. All right? Okay, the time is up. Yeah.